From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. Day two of the L.A. City School Strike. Yesterday, about a third of students attended as teachers picketed at most campuses. The district lost about $25 million in state funding from just that one day. We'll hear from parents of kids who went to school yesterday, find out what the students did, and whether they went back to campus this morning.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an evening master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Priority deadline to apply is January 21st at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Such a pleasure to have you with us. Coming up, Governor Newsom's threat to withhold gas tax funds from cities and counties that don't see enough construction to keep up with population growth. Housing advocates applaud it, but it's got plenty of critics in local government. We'll debate it later this hour. First, the second day of the teacher strike against LA Unified. Yesterday, about a third of students showed up. With state funding based on attendance, that means the district gets $25 million less than a typical school day. But if teachers don't end up being paid retroactively for the day off work, the district would save $10 million in salaries, net loss of $15 million. But if fewer students show up today and in subsequent days, the loss of state funding, of course, would be greater. I'd like to hear from you. If your child attended her or his LA school yesterday, what did they do? If you're a student in LA Unified and you went to school yesterday, but you're home today listening to Air Talk, as part of your education, I hope. Please join us at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, Air Talk page, kpecc.org. You can also tweet at Air Talk. If your parent who did send your child to school yesterday, based on what you heard, did you send them back today or not? 866-893-5722. By the way, students, I'll send a little note saying you attended the School of Air Talk by listening today. KPCC K through 12 reporter Kyle Stokes joins us. Kyle,
school's I'm going to need session. One of those slips.
Yeah, well, I'll write one for you too.
Yeah, perfect.
I know your boss. Let's start first of all with what's going on today. So we know teachers were out on the lines again this morning, and then they've got another group event they're attending.
Yeah, big rally coming up in about 20 minutes as planned in front of the headquarters of the California Charter Schools Association in downtown Los Angeles near Little Tokyo. Obviously charter schools are a big motivating issue for teachers because they've seen charter schools proliferate so much over the years and feel the threat of charter schools, which are public schools, but also compete with LAUSD district-run schools for students and funding. And teachers feel that threat. That's part of their motivating factor of this strike.
And of the charter schools, some of the teachers are unionized,
Some of them are unionized. And in fact, one of them, the Accelerated School, is a UTLA-represented school. And UTLA members just announced that the first charter school strike in the state of California is launching at that school as of today. So there are other schools as well that are UTLA represented or are at least union represented as well, but they are not joining in this as far as we know.
Again, I'd love to hear from you if you're a parent of a student in LA Unified, if you sent your child to school yesterday. I'd like to hear what the experience was like. What did the kids do? If you're a student in LA Unified, I'd love to hear from you if you're home today, but you attended yesterday. What did you do at your school and what made you decide, presumably in consultation with your parents, that you wouldn't go back today? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page. Daniela in Reseda, good to have you with us. Your son went to school yesterday?
Yes, he did. He's a ninth grader, and he sent me pictures and told me that all 9th, 10th, and 11th, and 12th graders were in the auditorium together watching things on the screen that was very far away, doing seventh grade math problems.
Ooh.
Not going to school until the teachers come back.
Okay, so just a waste of a day as far as he was concerned.
Totally, yeah.
And what did you do to, did you have to make special arrangements for your son to be home, or you felt okay him being home on his own today?
Yeah, he's fine. He's old enough to be home on his own.
Yeah, he's ninth grade. Okay, he's in high school. So yeah. So you're not going to go back until the teachers return?
That's correct.
All right. Did you talk with your son about any sort of alternative education things so he's got something to do today and isn't just bored when he's home?
Yes, he's, he's doing online stuff. Several of the classes that he is in do a lot of things online, and the teachers actually gave them things to do, and that's what he's working on.
Now, it sounds like at his school, at least, there were quite a few kids there if they were stuffed into an auditorium. Did he have a sense of how many of his friends and classmates showed up?
About two-thirds. The school he goes to is from grade 4 through 12, so there's a lot of students at the school, and so there's middle schoolers and elementary school kids. And they were all rotated through the larger areas, and they were all sort of like housed together in groups.
Daniela, good to hear from you. Thanks so much for sharing your son's experience yesterday. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page. The chance for us on Air Talk to hear from parents, the challenges of having kids going to school where they're typically grouped into larger classrooms or into auditoriums because there just aren't enough substitute teachers to actually teach classes. And Kyle, this is kind of the contingency plan at most campuses, right?
This is the contingency plan at most campuses. Yesterday, I was at an LAUSD campus. It's called Reseda Charter High School. Don't let the charter in the name fool you. It's an LAUSD-run school. Very similar to what the caller was describing. In some respects, there were, you know, students at one point who were in an auditorium. They were watching a TED Talk, and then they were writing in reaction about it. There were also, the principal was trying as best as she could to provide really meaningful things for the kids to do, including doing things that she would normally be pulling kids out of their core classes to do, like doing a college prep program that's sort of this online program, doing an assessment for some of her in English for some of her juniors. So things that she would normally have to pull out of kids in class for. But I still saw, you know, there were also a lot of kids that were cycling when they weren't doing that on the computer. They were in a gym. They were shooting hoops. They were, you know, kind of hanging out. They were on their phones. So I think the reality is, I mean, this was a school where the district sort of invited us in to see. And there, I think the principals are doing the best they can with what they have, but it clearly is not an optimal learning situation.
And I wonder if any of the teachers, in anticipation of striking, talk to the students about things to do to sort of, you know, stay up in the, particularly at the high school level, in the subject areas, and sort of gave them advance assignments in anticipation that they might be grouped in an auditorium with no work in that subject.
I've heard tell of that. I haven't had that confirmed. I do think some teachers were interested in doing that, but I have not confirmed this firsthand from any of the teachers who've done this assignment. If you are one of those teachers,
yeah,
maybe they can also
call
in or
tweet
me. Yeah, it
would be good to hear. Yeah. If you're a striking teacher, it'd be good to hear what, if any, contingencies you made with your students, what encouragement so that they wouldn't fall behind in the class that you teach just in case the strike is a prolonged one. Did you get into that? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Kayla in Encino, welcome to Air Talk. Hi, Kayla.
Hi,
you're a student, I understand. Where do you go to school?
I go to school at SOSIS.
Okay, is that an elementary
the
or middle school?
Oaks, Center for Enriched Studies.
Ah, very good. Yeah. And what grade are you in, Kayla?
I am in fifth grade.
Fifth grade, okay. So you're right on that cusp of elementary and middle school. So you went yesterday. What did they do at your school?
Well, at my school, they didn't do breakfast at all.
Which really?
It was kind of weird because usually we get breakfast in the morning.
And I was told that breakfast would still be provided for students.
Right.
Kyle, that's a little surprising to hear.
Yeah, I'm surprised to hear that, Kayla.
So you didn't have so you had to go without breakfast in the morning?
Yeah.
Okay, that's no good. So then what did you do during the school day?
During the school day, we didn't do much at all. They just said, go on the computers and do whatever you want. They didn't give us any instructions, really. And, like, then we had to go to the gym, and they said, okay, just run around, stretch, do whatever you want. And because of that, I ended up getting knocked over onto the floor because it was a bunch of fifth and fourth graders in the same room. And, yeah.
Well, that's, boy, it sounds like kind of a rough day. So did, then in the afternoon when your school day came to a close, you talked with your parents about going back today?
Well, I said to my dad, like, could I not go to school? Because I got totally knocked over because people were watching us and people weren't saying, don't run all over the place. And so my dad said, okay, you don't have to go to school, but you have to come to the museum with me. So, yeah.
Well, that sounds like a good deal. So which museum did you go to or are you going to?
Right now, we are going to the La Brea Tar Pits.
Oh, the La Brea Tar Pits. That sounds like a lot better than sitting in a big auditorium and just being told to go online. That's terrific, Kayla. That sounds great. And I'll tell you what, since you listen to Air Talk, if you want to come by and watch the show while you're off school, we'll take your phone number and you and your dad can come visit and see how we do the radio program. That'd probably be educational for you, too.
Oh, thanks.
All right. Okay, Kayla, thanks so much. We appreciate your firsthand report on what it was like at your school yesterday. And have a good time at the Tar Pits. I know you will. And the Page Museum that's there as well. Kayla in Encino joining us. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Kyle, at least, you know, in Kayla's account, sounds like not a lot of supervision. And it sounds like there weren't really plans for what to have the kids more specifically do during the day.
Which runs a little bit counter to what the district had said, which that there would be these sort of grab and go, you know, curricular plans available. I mean, we're talking about a basic math problem of supervision. We're talking about, you know, 2,000 administrators pulled from central office jobs and 400 non-union substitutes that could be called on, plus whatever, you know, sort of classified staff is what they call them, the non-teaching but still unionized staff that at least at the schools that weren't holding sympathy strikes on campus. For instance, at the high school that I was at, there were 600 students there, 600 to 700 students, and the principal estimated maybe 70 staff people, including people who were doing things like serving breakfast and serving lunch. So, you know, like it's a basic math problem of quality. Like you can only do so much for these students with a limited number of adults to take care of them.
Yeah, just it would be nice if they had at least some more sort of grade appropriate things and specific. I don't know. I feel like I could you know, not take too long to figure out where, you know, what to, sort of basic educational assignments to give kids during the course of the day that would be interesting for them, involve some research, a little bit of writing, and that you could make that. It just doesn't seem like that'd be that hard to do.
It does sound very, very intuitive, but, you know, we're talking about students who need different things, who are at different grade levels. You're
sure.
Trying to provide developmentally appropriate things to do. There are, you know, for instance, at the school yesterday, I was talking about, like, there were 10th graders who were doing, you know, test prep that was geared toward their level because of assessments that they had previously taken, and they can do that online. But, you know, Superintendent Austin Buettner was asked about this in this morning's press conference, and he said, you know, about these reports about students on their phones and sort of just kind of hanging out as we're hearing. And he's like, look, we wish their teachers were in school. We wish that this wasn't happening, but it is. And I think there's a little bit of acknowledgement here that this isn't ideal. And we're not going to have, you know, the high quality of learning that you would see
I mean, that would be unrealistic to, I guess. I'm saying there's got to be something between what Kayla described in the auditorium yesterday and what kids typically get in the more customized educational environment. Nicole in Inglewood, I understand you've got a 4-year-old daughter. So is she in a pre-K program?
She is. She's in early transitional kindergarten, and she's in the LAUSD district. So she goes to Cimarron Elementary. And we've actually been taking her to school in the morning just so she can get more present, because I know the district loses money based on if children are not in the classroom or not. So we take her there long enough to be marked present in the morning and then pick her up after that And she's just been hanging out with us all day.
All right. Well, is what she's doing in the morning, or at least yesterday, and I don't know, you probably haven't talked with her yet today, but yesterday, was it different than a typical day for her?
Oh, absolutely. There's hardly any kids at the school, so all of the students can fit in the auditorium and the library. So that's where all the kids are. And they're just doing worksheets and just a lot of playtime, which I know is a lot of fun for them. When I picked her up today, they were in the library looking at a movie.
Okay. Well, I'm glad it was fun for her. Nicole, thanks very much. Appreciate your sharing your experience as a parent. Michelle in Eagle Rock said that she figured it's just going to be a bunch of kids sitting in an auditorium, so she didn't send her seventh grade son to school. She also said that she actually wanted to send a message with the district losing the average daily attendance from the state with her son not going to school, to send a message in support of the teachers who were striking. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Kyle, thanks so much. We'll let you get back. I know you're working on a major feature for LAist about this, and we'll follow your on-air reporting as well in the days to come.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Kyle Stokes, KPECC, K-12 reporter. It's Air Talk on KPECC. A big vote in Parliament on Brexit today. We'll talk about where things stand. We'll be back 1 minute on Air Talk. Such a pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I know it was just a few weeks ago we were talking about the shaky political future of British Prime Minister Theresa May, the Brexit agreement that her negotiators reached with EU officials on shaky ground, a Parliament vote today on Brexit and the details. With us, reporter from the Wall Street Journal who covers Britain, Brexit, and UK politics, Max Colchester. Max is at Parliament covering the vote today. Thanks so much, Max, for joining us.
You're welcome.
So where do we stand? Is the vote scheduled to get underway in the next few minutes?
Yes, exactly. In about half an hour, British lawmakers are expected to roundly reject a Brexit deal that British Prime Minister Theresa May spent over a year trying to negotiate with EU counterparts to extract the UK from the EU. And this throws the whole process into a whole new realm of disarray, as the British people have to wonder sort of how the UK will exit the EU, and even if they will.
Well, and so let's take a hypothetical. Let's say we get, is March when the deadline is, does that still stand?
Exactly. So in theory, the UK will crash out of the European Union at the end of March if an agreement isn't found with the EU to smooth its exit. So in theory, everyone's building up to that deadline.
So let's just say hypothetically there's no agreement on the terms of exit from the EU, that there are no sorts of agreements on how trade is going to be handled. What then happens at that point? I mean, how does the UK trade with other European countries?
Well, that's a subject of much debate. I mean, what we do know is that after this expected loss tonight, the British Prime Minister Theresa May will probably go back to the EU and wring some concessions from them and basically put this back to Parliament again ahead of this March deadline, in the hope that she can assuage rebels in her own party that this actually this deal will be good for the UK and will allow them to trade and make trade deals with the likes of the US once we leave the EU. But it's an extremely emotional and emotive topic here. And I think a lot of people are extremely divided over what should happen next. I mean, you mentioned I was in Parliament. I'm sitting in this old palace right now. Outside, there are hundreds of people waving flags, some saying we should have a second vote about the Brexit referendum should be rerun to make sure that people really know they want to leave. Others are saying that we should leave without an exit deal and just quit and trade on World Trade Organization terms with the rest of the world, which could potentially be economically damaging for the UK, but would guarantee that Brexit at least would happen.
What are the chances that there would be a re-vote on Brexit, and what is public opinion polling in the UK show about whether there's been any movement on public opinion?
Well, the chances of a revote in the end look relatively slim still, because in the end it would require the government to agree to a revote, and Prime Minister Theresa May repeatedly said she does not favour that option. However, as the chaos continues, you can't really rule out anything at this point. Public opinion has been slowly moving in favour of a second referendum. However, it seems that the most thing people can agree on is that they don't want to crash out of the EU without a trade deal, because they worry about jobs and the impact that would have on the British economy.
Max, what about the so-called backstop between Northern Ireland and Ireland? How central is that to the dispute over the terms of Brexit?
That's very central to the center of this debate. Essentially, lawmakers are worried that once the UK leaves the EU, if they agree to Theresa May's deal, they will be stuck in a kind of transition period with the EU for years and years before a formal trade deal is signed off with the EU, and the UK is then free to go and hash out trade deals with the likes of the US. And so there's a deep concern here that by signing off on this deal, the UK ends up in a kind of limbo with the EU controlling a lot of regulations and having a lot of say over how the UK runs its affairs without the UK being able to influence the EU. So reassuring lawmakers about that is a very key thing for Prime Minister Theresa May to do.
Max, thank you for giving us the latest developments ahead of the parliamentary vote on the terms of Brexit. We appreciate it very much. Thank you. And we'll, of course, be following up tomorrow after the vote to see where things stand. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Max Colchester of The Wall Street Journal, who covers Britain, Brexit, UK politics. He's at British Parliament for the vote, scheduled to get underway in just about half an hour. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. As you know, Governor Newsom unveiled his budget proposal last Thursday, and he made a lot of news with the various initiatives that he set as priorities. One of them is to create new housing targets for every region of California. And the governor threatened to withhold transportation funding for cities and counties that didn't clear that bar. His budget also including about $2 billion in funding for various homelessness and housing initiatives. Proponents of housing say it's an important thing for the state government to have a stick that it can use to try and get areas to comply with creating more housing as their populations grow. But opponents say that that's very unfair to some regions of the state where there are a variety of factors beyond NIMBYism or government hurdles to housing construction. With us to talk about the governor proposal is Alan Greenlee, Executive Director of the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing. Mr. Greenlee, thank you for being with us.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So what do you see as the advantage of the governor tying transit funding to housing starts for a city or a county? How could that help actually more housing be constructed?
Well, I think the proposal certainly is an effort to get the attention of everybody in California to help them understand that the governor is serious about addressing our housing affordability crisis that we have. I think that we're early in the process, and we'll figure out whether that's the right stick or not as we move through the legislative process. And I look forward to a robust discussion today about what's the right approach. But I do think that he's asked the right question, which essentially is, what can the state do to intervene into the market to in a myriad of ways, but in this case, to encourage localities to be more aggressive in the question of housing production.
Well, and I mean, $2 billion on the one hand sounds like a lot of state money, but you know better than me that given the cost of construction these days and land acquisition, that money's going to go pretty fast. So how much of a carrot is that really in this proposal?
Well, I think, you know, that on top of resources that have been made available through the ballot over the last handful of years. So, you know, don't forget, for example, that just this past November, there was about $6 billion that was passed by the voters to apply to the question of housing folks that are of low income and who are homeless. So it coupled on top existing resources, it's a pretty significant investment. And then I think the other issue to remember at the beginning of this conversation, Larry, is that we've gotten ourselves into this situation not yesterday, not the day before, not the year before, but over the course of essentially a generation of slow growth policies applied both at the state and local level, and that the solution is going to require a varied array of interventions, and they're going to have to be applied over a long period of time. And so I think on behalf of our members, we are encouraged by having the governor of California join us in the conversation about housing affordability, which we think is kind of a new day. And we look forward to continuing to work with the governor and other stakeholders to make sure that we move in a productive and positive direction.
Alan Greenlee, Executive Director, Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing, also with us from the California State Association of Counties, Chris Lee, who's legislative representative. Mr. Lee, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What are your concerns about tying state transportation funding to construction of housing?
Well, first off, I want to say that we're very thankful for the governor's recognition that this problem is going to require state resources and state attention to the issue. And I think our fundamental problem is really with the premise here. We're very concerned that under our current housing goals, we plan for a lot more affordable housing, below market rate housing, than there is subsidy to build those units. So if we're talking about the goals that are in place today, we're very concerned that in a lot of jurisdictions, you'd simply be setting up the jurisdiction for failure. And so we want to make sure that there's a proposal that really takes into account what is the role of the county government, the folks that I represent, or the local government in making sure that housing is delivered, and what are the limitations of the powers that we have. So we really are very concerned about holding us accountable for below market rate production if there's not sufficient subsidy. And then on the other side, on the market rate side, there needs to be a recognition of the limitations of what local government can control and what the market produces.
If you factored in all of those limitations, the market as well as the subsidies, which you say are just not sufficient to meet the demand for below market level housing, then do you think that you'd have any cities or counties left who aren't doing everything that they can?
Well, and I can't speak for the cities. I do represent the association that represents all 58 counties in California before the state legislature and federal government. But, I think that's going to be an evolving conversation, right? The details, as Alan pointed out, aren't fully in print, and we're just raising concerns with the general premise, because when there have been past attempts at this, we feel like they haven't necessarily recognized all those limitations.
But I guess what I'm asking is, do you think that we'll take counties because those are your members? Do you think that there are counties that really are not paying sufficient attention to this? That even with inadequate subsidies, that there's a lot more that they could be doing and should be doing?
I think there's a lot more that the state can be doing. I think all of us recognize that there's a shortage of housing, and it's incumbent on all policymakers at all levels to try to increase production. I think we just have to be very careful to make sure that any incentive funding or any sort of punishment for not getting housing produced is really tailored narrowly to the factors that are under local government control, if that makes sense.
All right, Chris Lee with us from the California State Association of Counties. Coming up, we'll hear from the policy director at UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation, David Garcia. And I'd like to hear from you. What do you think about this, particularly if you're someone who spends a lot of time in this area of housing construction, of subsidies, of nonprofit housing? If this is something in your wheelhouse, you work in this area, I'd like to hear what you think about Governor Newsom's proposal that transportation funding be withheld from regions that aren't, in the state's view, doing its fair share to construct new housing. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdy's. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, and I sure hope to see you Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, exactly a week before the Academy Awards. It's our annual Film Week Academy Award preview. We'll have all of our critics on stage at the Theater at Ace Hotel. We'll show clips of the Oscar-nominated films. Last year sold out. We want you to be there. Make sure you get your tickets. Visit kpecc.org/in-person. Get your tickets now, Sunday afternoon, February 17th. Theater at Ace Hotel. It's going to be a lot of fun. Looks like a wide-open Oscar race this year, not just for Best Picture, but in all the major categories as well. So we'll have a vigorous debate among our critics, I'm sure. Each of them have kind of staked out their favorites during this awards season. Please join us February 17th, Sunday afternoon, Theater at Ace Hotel. Right now, our focus is on housing in California, where so many communities have a housing crisis, simply not enough units for a growing population, or the influx of people who've come as the economy's booming and jobs have been created. Governor Newsom, in last Thursday's debut of his proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year, said that he would like to see the state actually withhold transportation funding from communities that are not meeting the requirement to create enough housing to accommodate the growth in population. What do you think about that? And again, if you're someone who is in the housing arena, maybe you work in the construction industry, maybe you're in local government, maybe you have front row seat as this plays out in your community, call us now at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. From UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation, Policy Director David Garcia is with us. Ms. Garcia, good morning.
Morning, Larry. Thank you very much for having me.
Your thoughts on attempting to tie transportation funding. I mean, do you think that that's a legitimate link to make?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is. And I think in the governor's press briefing, he made that same point, that housing and transportation are really inseparable. And that makes a lot of sense from that point of view. When looking at that specific proposal, I think it's important to remember, I echo some of what my colleague Chris mentioned earlier. Cities don't necessarily have control over what gets built in their cities from a perspective of, do they have the subsidies to build the necessary affordable housing? Do they have the market conditions necessary to build market rate housing? And there's a lot of places across the state, thinking of Central Valley or the Inland Empire, where the market conditions don't necessarily lead to the sufficient construction of new housing. So the details are going to be really important as the governor and the legislature thinks about how to implement this policy proposal to make sure that we don't inadvertently lump in cities that really need that funding and don't really have control over building in their communities to separate them from the communities that are being more exclusionary.
Well, let's take the Inland Empire as a prime example here. If more housing is generated there than currently being developed, that potentially puts more people on the major freeways into coastal Southern California because of the mismatch between jobs in the Inland Empire and in coastal L.A. and Orange County. So if you link transportation funding to that, in that sense, isn't it actually a reverse link?
I think you could make that argument, but I think, and the governor wasn't really specific on whether or not that's going to be gas tax dollars. When he was pressed on the topic, he actually said it may be other types of transportation funding. But I think you if you're not careful in how you structure this policy, it could somewhat be a bit of a reverse incentive. So I think that's a very important detail that needs to be worked out. And again, this is all very high level, right? We're having this conversation based on a couple of lines from Governor Newsom's press briefing. This isn't in writing yet, so there is a lot of speculation happening right now. But I think at a high level, it's really important that we have both incentives and enforcement mechanisms to make sure that all cities are creating their fair share of housing. Now, in the budget proposal, there was a lot of incentives. There was about $7 billion, or $700 million, I should say, for cities who are meeting various housing goals. So it makes sense that there would be a similarly large and ambitious enforcement mechanism by withholding transportation funds.
RTB writes on the AirTalk page, I recall the state-created ads ran every 5 minutes telling us if we took away the gas tax, our roads would continue to crumble and your 911 calls would go unresponded to as emergency vehicles would fall into potholes on the way. Now Newsom will take away those funds from cities if they don't build enough low-cost housing to satisfy him. I'm quite sure if this argument was presented to Newsom, he'd say, no worry, there'll be enough money to keep the roads safe. So much for the gas tax essential to public safety. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org, or call us at 866-893-KPCC. Vivian in Encino says, I think the smartest solution would be to reuse existing locations, retrofit, adapt those locations, instead of creating new housing. Is this seriously been considered? Well, in fact, Alan Greenlee of the Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing in urban areas, that's much of where the new housing is being created, right?
That's correct, yeah. So the localities, particularly in Southern California, the major coastal communities have done what I would consider to be a pretty good job of making public land available. I think there are, as you mentioned, to the Inland Empire, there are areas, communities where they have started to put publicly held land on the market for affordable housing development, which I think is really important. And so I think Vivian's on to something there. I do want to also make sure that to comment on this idea of the penalty, essentially, for communities that are not meeting their goals. I think there's a real serious public policy question to ask about how do you differentiate between communities that happen to exist under economic conditions that don't necessarily enable the development of residential real estate, and what capacities does the local government have to do to change that economic dynamic, and which communities are using the existing housing needs assessment strategies and policies to just hide behind a slow growth agenda. And, one of the things I think is interesting about what the governor's put on the table, this idea of taking vital resources away, is that it really does call the question about creating a distinction between good actors and bad actors. And I think that's a debate that we need to have, not only in the public space, but at the legislative space.
Well, let's talk about the notion of bad actors here, because there are communities, cities, for example, who can make the argument, look, we do want a slow growth. There are a lot of people who'd like to live in our community. We're not under an obligation to house everybody who wants to live here. And it's unfair for the state to put that expectation on us that we should somehow be forced to accommodate an overall growing mix of population in Southern California. Alan, what's your response to that?
My response is that we're all in this together, and that there's a contribution that every single locality can make. One of the connections I think that's really important, and I think I'm not sure that the withholding of cash on that transportation money is actually hits the point, but I do think that the notion of the overlap between housing need and transportation infrastructure as a siting tool, as a location tool, is a really important item to consider. So, because theoretically, in essence, if you have a robust transportation infrastructure, that's a geography, that's an actual space on the map where you can say, you know what, this is a community that can handle more density. And I get that the neighbors in those communities are going to get upset, but to the extent that residents, particularly low-income residents who are high propensity users of transportation, live close to that amenity, then we get sort of all the benefits, right? We get housing, we get housing affordability, we get higher use of transportation resources, we get lower greenhouse gas emissions, and we get less traffic. And so that's a public policy concept, I think, that makes a lot of sense. So that transportation and housing combination is something really for us to spend a lot of time thinking about.
Alan Greenlee, Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing, Chris Lee, the California State Association of Counties, and David Garcia, UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation. Our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Like to hear your thoughts about Governor Newsom's proposal to withhold transportation tax revenues from communities that don't build what the state determines to be those communities' fair share of affordable housing. Back with more on Air Talk in just 1 minute. Always a pleasure to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well. If you're someone who's evacuating from the burn areas where local officials have asked you to leave your house out of concerns for mudslides, debris flows, we wish you all the best. We are with you in spirit over these next couple of days in which heavy rain is expected, particularly tomorrow and Thursday. We're at 866-893-KPCC, the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Meg posted on the AirTalk Facebook page, I think the governor's on the right track. City officials need cover to create multifamily housing. NIMBYs oppose that kind of thing so much it can't go forward. Look what happened with SB 50 the last time around. SB 50 was Democratic State Senator Scott Wiener's bill that looked at punishing communities, essentially taking away their right to veto development near transit hubs. And one of the arguments against that was that transit hubs essentially meant any major street that had public buses going up and down it. Again, we're talking about Governor Newsom's proposal to not provide transit funding to communities that don't build what the state determines are their fair share of affordable housing. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Joaquin in South L.A. writes on the page, Newsom is showing more deference to cities than I would. He's putting the incentives at the end of the housing production process, giving cities time and freedom to do as they please. The alternative is Scott Wiener's way. We can smash their restrictive zoning codes. Cities should welcome Newsom's gentle touch. Doing nothing is no longer an option. That's Joaquin in South Los Angeles. Chris Lee of the California State Association of Counties, do you want to respond to Joaquin's post? Are you there, Chris?
I did want to jump back to the comment about the gas tax and really point out that voters have consistently said they want transportation dollars going to transportation purposes. They don't want them being diverted, and they certainly don't want it to be withheld. They want it spent quickly. And so I think that sort of overlays this entire conversation and it is another wrinkle that we have to consider as we talk about this policy. You in general.
All right. And could you respond to Joaquin's point about contrasting Newsom's approach to Senator Wiener's bill from last session?
Yeah, and I will be having conversations again. Senator Wiener has reintroduced that bill, and we'll talk about the details there. But I think there are definitely two different approaches. I think we do appreciate the incentives that the governor has included, but as I've stated on the call, we're very concerned about the potential of withholding transportation funding, especially based on the current housing planning goals that we have, which really just aren't reflective of the total resources available for those affordable units. So, of course, and the discussion is going to include all of those parts, and I think there's pros and cons to different approaches.
Let's talk with Brian in Hollywood. Good to have you with us.
Hi. My frustration with all of this is that it's accurate data of counting of available units. I live in Hollywood, and we always hear there's not enough units, but Los Angeles has no way of accurately counting, and the New York Times recently just put out a map of every single home in Los Angeles, so why cannot we attach if those are available or not, so we really understand what is needed before we do any overarching planning.
David Garcia, UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation, is that a problem that some of the state's largest cities have, is having an accurate count?
I think to a certain extent it is, but I think we do have pretty good data that shows that for the last few decades, really, we have been seriously underbuilding housing, not just in the Los Angeles or Southern California region, but across the state. I think sometimes we view the relatively recent uptick in construction cranes and new buildings and assume that we're in a big building boom. But if you look at the number of units we built in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, we were routinely, as a state, building upwards of 200,000 units per year, sometimes almost close to 300,000. And this year coming up, we'll be building about 100,000 units per year. And we know we have a serious deficit. So while I can, as a member of a research organization, I can always appreciate the need for more and better data, I think we have plenty of evidence that shows that we have a serious shortage of units overall, and we can start planning policies around that concept.
David, one of the arguments against constructing more miles of freeway in Southern California is that, you know, when you build it into areas that are undeveloped, it just leads to more sprawl. The freeways get congested yet again, that you can't build your way out of it because you just create more traffic. Contrast that to the argument about building more housing with the notion that you ever really get sufficient units in a boom area that's got a lot of jobs, that, you know, one of the inhibitions arguably against even more jobs being created is the cost of housing. So what's to keep housing from falling into the same sort of argument as freeway construction, that you can never get ahead of that curve?
So I think that's a fair comparison, except for the fact that we're talking about homes and people, you know, where people actually live and where they would like to choose to live and to work. And, you know, I think it's fair to think that, you know, Governor Newsom had a pretty audacious goal of 3.5 million new homes. Even if we got to that level, would we have stability in the housing market across California? I don't know that we can accurately answer that, but we would have built millions of new homes, and that would be millions of people who would be able to live in California. And I think that's important. So it may be that, you know, we're kind of inducing demand by building more homes, but at the same time, those are more people who get to live closer to their jobs. And that aligns really closely with other goals we have as a state as well, including meeting our greenhouse gas emissions targets.
Alan Greenlee, Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing. Your response to Brian in Hollywood about, in his Hollywood Hills West community, the difficulty getting accurate housing count of available units.
Well, I do think that the system that we use now to set the goals for housing need is flawed, and it needs some adjustment. I think the idea that, for example, I know that you can identify locations that are zoned for the right kind of housing, but they're currently occupied as part of your report to the state about what's possible in your region, is a concept that exists in the current scenario. And so I think we need to take a long, hard look at how you assess what is needed in an area and what is possible to build. So data, I think, is an important contributor. I wonder if I might talk.
I'm sorry, Alan, but we're out of time. I would love to have you at that. Now I'm curious what it is, but we're out of time. I'm so sorry. I'm sure you'll be back with us in the coming weeks as we talk more about California's housing crisis. Alan Greenlee, Southern California Association of Nonprofit Housing. Chris Lee, the California State Association of Counties. David Garcia, UC Berkeley's Turner Center for Housing Innovation. Tear Talk on 89.3. KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology program with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, and is designed for working professionals, preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Classes start September. Apply by January 21st to be considered for a $4,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Southern California, the home of Hollywood, Dodgers, Disneyland. Sometimes it feels like paradise. But any second now, that could change, because a big earthquake is coming.
This will happen. There's no likelihood of it not happening. We are not stopping plate tectonics.
When the earthquake hits, our world will be shaken. So what can you do to prepare? I'm Jacob Margolis, host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Coming up later this hour, the effort to create a device that accurately determines how much pain a patient is in. It's a real challenge, that relationship between doctors, caregivers, and patients to get an objective measure of how much pain someone's really experiencing. Can technology solve that problem? We'll look at it later this hour. But first, a couple of major court cases. One you just heard about a couple minutes ago. That is a federal judge in New York barring the Trump administration from adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census. U.S. District Judge Jesse Furman didn't get to the issue of the constitutionality of the question itself. But he ruled that proper procedures were not followed to determine that the question needed to be added to the census. With us, the latest on this and the other suits that are involved against the citizenship question is Politico chief polling analyst Stephen Shepard. Stephen, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
So are these all these different cases here in California, the other states, are they all largely asking the same questions?
Yes, which is in essence, is the Trump administration both following the proper procedure is it proper to add the citizenship question to the 2020 census? Specifically, in some of the other cases, they've asked, did the Trump administration willingly ignore warnings from some data scientists that adding the citizenship question could actually affect the count in the census in a negative way, that it would discourage some people from completing the census and, as a result, lead to a less accurate count of the number of people in the United States as of April 1st, 2020.
Do you know if we've ever had previous lawsuits against the methodology of the census? We haven't had the citizenship question challenge that I'm aware of, but other things that people have challenged because they thought it would lead to a less accurate count.
You know, some of the other lawsuits that we've had filed with regard to the census questions, you've had people challenge whether it should be legally mandated in the past. Both the census and a much more extensive surveys that the census conducts outside of the decennial effort to track the U.S. population. There have been a number of legal challenges, but this one is a little bit different because, like I said, this one is from a lot of folks who are concerned that adding the citizenship question, which the administration says would collect valuable data, adding that question imposes a burden that could lead to a less accurate count.
Stephen Shepard, the U.S. Supreme Court next month scheduled to hear the question of whether a federal government official should have to be deposed or questioned about the process of making a decision on this, and share with us how that factors into this, because that still wouldn't ultimately decide this case.
That's not what the Supreme Court, what it's being asked to consider, at least at the outset prior to this ruling today, is whether the Commerce Secretary, the census falls under the Commerce Department, can be compelled to testify about the decision making that went into this, and whether as some Democrats and immigration rights activists suggest, the administration is adding this actually to depress the count of some minority populations in order to gain a political advantage in reapportionment for Republican-controlled states, that they want to compel Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary, to testify. That is already going before the Supreme Court. But you mentioned all the cases that are kind of winding their way through the courts in this ruling today out of New York, which is a separate case. All of that means that the Supreme Court is likely going to have to grapple with the underlying issues, not just that specific question of whether officials should be compelled to testify, but whether the Trump administration can be permitted to allow this question to be on the questionnaire that goes out to all Americans in early 2020.
And is there an actual date that's set for the census questionnaires to be mailed?
So the census questionnaires will be delivered mostly in March of 2020. The voluntary internet portion of the census, which if you don't want to fill out what you get in the mail, you can go on the internet. That begins in the beginning of March 2020. However, because they have to send out all these mailers to all these Americans, these need to be printed this year. So there is a pretty hard deadline. Most folks suggest it could be over the summer. And obviously the Supreme Court, when it comes to hearing cases and then deciding cases outside of really exigent circumstances, leaves town between July and October. So there are a lot of folks who expect that this could come before the court before the end of its term in June, and it might need to follow a timeline like that in order to sort this out by the time it's time to print out all these census forms.
Stephen Shepard, thanks so much for talking with us about this morning's New York District Court decision. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Politico's chief polling analyst, Stephen Shepard, with us. Also with us to talk about the legal aspects of these different challenges to the citizenship question on the next year's census, Case Western Reserve University Professor Jonathan Enten. Professor Enten, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think it is inevitable that the Supreme Court takes up not just the issue of whether Wilbur Ross would be forced to testify about the decision-making, but the general issue as to whether the Trump administration can include the question?
Well, I think that there's going to be an effort from the administration to get the Supreme Court to take up the more general point. In some ways, whether Secretary Ross can be compelled to testify in the New York case doesn't matter because the judge has now issued his ruling without Secretary Ross's testimony. But the bigger question about the citizenship question remains, and as a previous guest indicated, as a practical matter, the court will have to move very quickly if it's going to rule in this census cycle before the questionnaire has to go out.
What is the objective decision the court has to reach? I mean, for example, is the issue just will this depress participation? Is the issue whether there was a political motive and an intent to depress participation? Is this about whether the information gleaned from one's citizenship could be importantly factored into future federal government decisions? Sort of what is the standard here that a court ultimately is going to be called to decide?
The standard is going to depend on the precise question before the court. In the New York case and in the other two cases, the one that's now being tried in California and the one that will go on trial in Maryland next week, there are actually two broad questions. One is a constitutional question. There, the issue is the citizenship question being used for the precise purpose of discouraging Latinos and other minorities from participating in the census? There you need something close to smoking gun evidence. And the New York judge said, although there's powerful evidence, there's not enough. But there's a second issue here that's not a constitutional question. It has to do with the way the Secretary of Commerce and other government officials go about making decisions. The government can't just, or officials can't just decide what they think is the right thing to do. They have to be able to provide a legally sufficient reason, a coherent enough explanation. And here we look at what information was available to the government, in this case Secretary Ross, at the time he made the decision. Does the decision follow reasonably closely from the information that was available? And in the New York case, the judge said, no, there's all kinds of reason to think that the decision does not follow from the information that was available to the secretary, and therefore it is unlawful, and they can't include the citizenship question on the 2020 census.
I guess what confuses me about that is, you know, we have these debates about, well, how many U.S. residents are undocumented in the country? I mean, this is and there are all kinds of estimates and projections on that. Wouldn't there just on the face of it? And I'm setting aside the issue of depressing the count. So I'm setting aside negative potential repercussions from that. But just looking at the argument from the Trump administration perspective, isn't there just sort of on the face of it an argument that having an accurate count of who is documented or not is of value?
There's certainly value to knowing things like that, but it's not like a totally straightforward analysis. After all, if you ask about citizenship on the census, it is possible, this is a matter of some controversy, but it is possible that some people will not participate, so we will get a less accurate overall count. So there's a trade-off to be made. Moreover, there are other ways for the government to estimate with reasonable confidence the number of people who are citizens and the number of people who are unlawfully in the country. And up until now, the federal government has used those other methods to come up with those figures. And so there is a debate, to be sure, about whether those alternative methods provide an accurate enough count. But there's also the question, and again, we don't know the answer. Part of what's going on in this case is that the professional people in the Census Bureau were concerned that without an adequate field test of a citizenship question, we might get a much less accurate overall count of the population, and that's also something that we should be concerned about.
Well, and then how does the court decide sort of what's the greater good here? Because that's sort of the issue that's at play. So the administration argues we're going to get a more accurate count of citizenship status of the American people. Yes, some people may not fill out, but the greater good is we're still going to get a more accurate count. On the other hand, you're going to have people say this is really going to do serious harm to communities that rely on having an accurate count of how many people are there and reimbursements of federal funding. All based on this, this is going to have a huge negative impact. So, I mean, is this ultimately a court just weighing the strengths of those comparative arguments?
No, that's not what a court does at all. The court is not going to make that call. The courts recognize that that's a call for the government, the executive branch, the Secretary of Commerce, to make. In this instance, the courts are asking only, was the information for the Secretary of Commerce when he made this decision sufficient to justify the decision that he made? And in the New York case, the judge said, no, the information that was available to the Secretary does not support the conclusion that he made, the decision that he made. So if he can't come up with a better explanation, then they can't ask the question. Now, if the Secretary has better information, then maybe we get to a different result. But as I said, the judge in New York or California or Maryland or the Supreme Court, if the case gets that far, those judges are not going to make the decision about whether it is better to have a complete citizenship count, even if we don't have as much participation, or whether it's more important to have a more participation and a less precise estimate of the number of citizens and non-citizens in the country.
Yeah, and so I guess you're saying that the amount of information that's available for the Secretary to make this ultimate call, that a court can make that determination without getting into the relative strengths of the pro-cons of asking the question on the census. I guess that's where it's sort of struggling to disentangle those two things, because it seems to be one infers the other. But
well, you've got it exactly right. The court is not going to make the call, but will ask, did the Secretary give an acceptable logical explanation for why the secretary made the call that he made. We don't ask courts to make these ultimate value judgments. The court in this case is simply going to say, you have to have a good reason. You have to have a coherent explanation for what you've done. And in this instance, the secretary failed that test.
I want to thank you so much, Professor, for being with us and talking about the complexity in this series of cases making their way through federal courts, perhaps ultimately to the U.S. Supreme Court, on the citizenship question that the Trump administration wants for the 2020 census. We appreciate it. That's Joseph Enten, Case Western University School of Law professor. Also, our thanks to Stephen Shepard of Politico. Coming up, another big court case in which a jury decided that the Mongol Motorcycle Club should have to give up its logo as a result of criminal activities of the motorcycle group. We'll hear the constitutional issues involved in that back in a minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Late last week, a Santa Ana jury ruled that the Southern California-based Mongols Motorcycle Club can be stripped of its trademark as part of the punishment in a racketeering case. That trademark war has been going on for decades. Gosh, I can't remember the first time that I covered a story involving the Mongols and law enforcement action against them. The motorcycle club has been accused and convicted in court cases involving inciting violence and drug dealers. Prosecutors hope that in getting rid of the Mongol logo, that it'll make it more difficult to recruit members to the club and also stop them from making money selling merchandise associated with the Mongols' MC logo. The motorcycle club was founded about 50 years ago in Montebello. It was started by a group of men who were reportedly rejected by the Hell's Angels. The trademark features a sunglasses-clad figure resembling Genghis Khan riding a motorcycle beneath the club's name. And you can see it on leather vests and jackets of Mongol members as they ride their motorcycles on Southern California freeways. Rather a common sight. With us to talk about whether the jury's decision withstands First Amendment scrutiny is Aaron Kaplan, Loyola Law School professor and a First Amendment specialist. Professor Kaplan, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
When I first saw this decision by the jury, it just seemed to me that, you know, a trademark, a logo for a motorcycle club isn't like quite the same as just physical property that the government can confiscate. What's your view on whether the federal government can actually take a trademark logo?
Yeah, I think that's a big problem with the prosecution's theory here, and it requires folks to understand some things about how trademarks work. Owning the trademark is different from owning a piece of property that has the trademark on it. So if the government decided that there was a box of jackets that was either used in racketeering or that was the proceeds of racketeering, I think we all agree the government could forfeit that particular box of jackets. But what a trademark is the right of some entity that is using a mark or an image as a way of identifying goods that it is selling. Goods or services that it is selling, it is their right to prevent other people from selling goods with the same image on it. So what that means is you can only have trademark rights in conjunction with an organization or a business that is actually using that mark as a way of identifying the goods. If the government says, we are taking control over your trademark, it doesn't entirely make sense under trademark law because you can't just sell a trademark by itself. You have to sell the business that creates those goods. So unless the government is saying, we're going to start running our own motorcycle club and we're going to call it the Mongols and we're going to sue anybody else who sells Mongols jackets, and I don't think any of those things are going to happen, I don't know that it's really meaningful to say that the government has taken control of the trademark.
Well, is there any precedent for this among any group that's been convicted of criminal wrongdoing among its members and has lost control of its name or its logo?
I'm not aware of it. Conceivably, there could be some situation where, you know, one faction of a group is convicted of criminal wrongdoing. They get removed from the organization, and the remaining people in the organization continue to exercise control over it. But I don't know of examples that sound like what you're describing.
We're talking with Aaron Kaplan, Loyola law professor, also with us, law professor as well from Chapman University, constitutional law specialist Lawrence Rosenthal. He's also a former federal prosecutor. Professor Rosenthal, welcome back.
Good to be here.
So you see this differently. How so?
Well, you know, the federal racketeering statute provides that any property, tangible or intangible, that's used to conduct racketeering activity is forfeitable. And the jury found that that's exactly how the Mongols use their logo, as a way of tagging their gang members and their criminal activity. Just like we know street gangs often use graffiti to tag their territory, well, the government's evidence in this case shows that the Mongols use their trademark in exactly that way. So forfeiture accomplishes two things, at least according to the evidence in this case. First, it deprives the people who run the gang of revenue because they actually do sell material like jackets with this logo on it. But second, and perhaps more importantly, street gang membership involves more than just economic motivation. Some of the really interesting research in this area shows criminal gang members don't actually earn that much money. There are a variety of non-economic kind of effective goals of these organizations. It gives people a sense of belonging in kind of an extended family. Sociologists have done some very interesting work here. And it may be that this is an intriguing and perhaps ultimately successful experiment in attacking the sociology of gang life by depriving these people of the mark that has been used to build this kind of extended criminal family. A sociologist might say this may be a novel experiment in law enforcement, but it's one worth having. It may be that this is the kind of blow that might mean more to this gang than simply sending a couple of its members to jail or taking their motorcycles away.
Is there First Amendment protection for trademarks that they are, you know, constitutionally protected expression?
It seems pretty clear that there's no serious First Amendment defense here. In 1993, the United States Supreme Court decided a case involving the same racketeering statute in which the defendant had engaged in a pattern of distributing obscene literature. And as a result, among other things, the jury ordered that the defendant forfeit all the assets of the bookstores that had been used to sell this, even books that weren't obscene and would otherwise be protected by the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court's reasoning was that laws that are neutral and generally applicable, that don't target speech, but in this case target property used to engage in unlawful activities, are perfectly constitutional even when they're applied to people engaged in First Amendment activities. Just like bookstores can't open without getting zoning permits, bookstores also have to obey the racketeering laws. And certainly the same principle applies to a street gang. If you use your trademark for unlawful purposes, then you can lose it the same way that anyone who uses their property for unlawful purposes is subject to the forfeiture laws.
Professor Kaplan, your thoughts on the precedent that Professor Rosenthal mentions.
Yeah, I disagree that case from 1993 applies the same way to intellectual property. It's definitely true that if someone has been engaged in racketeering and then they plow those profits back into a business, the physical assets of that business can be confiscated by the government, and then the government can sell them off and so on. Intellectual property is different because things like trademark or copyright and so on, it's expression, it's speech, and it is also infinitely reproducible. So the question is not, can the government take something away from someone who's convicted of racketeering? Yes, they can do that. Can the government stop people from saying, I like to identify with the Mongols organization. I like to view myself as a member of this club or this group. And I think there is very significant First Amendment protection for that. Back in the 1930s, California had a law that said no one is allowed to display a red flag as a symbol of socialism. And the U.S. Supreme Court said, wait a minute, people have a free speech right to say, I feel like a socialist. I want to express my solidarity with socialism. It's the same thing here. So the people who committed racketeering while they were involved in the Mongols, there's a lot of their property they can lose, but the government cannot make it illegal for anyone and everyone in the future to say, I want to express my membership and solidarity with certain other people.
Do you think that this is ripe for the U.S. Supreme Court to take up this issue?
Well, we're a long way from that because the trial court isn't quite finished with its work. Then there would be an appeal and then another. But if the question is this an open question that the Supreme Court might bring some clarity to? Yeah, it's a possibility.
And I also wonder just about, you know, from a law enforcement perspective, let me go back to you, Professor Rosenthal, because you've been a federal prosecutor. We do have the notion of redemption, and presumably not the only reason that people join the Mongols is to be involved in criminal activity. So is there a particular argument you could make that you're not giving the Mongols a chance for rehabilitation, for example, or the positives of that group if you take the logo away?
Well, you know, it's important to remember that this case only involves forfeiture. This is not a court order that's going to mean that nobody can say, I like the Mongols, or I identify with the Mongols, or even display symbols of the Mongols. What it does mean is you can no longer use, the gang can no longer use federal trademark law to control that symbol so that nobody else can use it. That's the property right that they have lost. Now, we're in an age where people are very critical of the government using solely incarceration as a way to enforce the law. And I think we properly look for alternatives to incarceration. And one way to fight the problem of criminal gangs is to focus on this membership. These symbols are terribly important to gangs. That's why conventional street gangs so often tag their turf with their symbols through graffiti. And anti-graffiti efforts have been an important part of the fight against street gangs. Well, this is really the same thing. It doesn't prevent people from saying, I like the Mongols. But it does prevent them from using federal trademark law in order to control this symbol, sell this symbol, market the symbol, hand it out in an exclusive way. And that may be an important blow against this gang without having to use the remedy of incarceration.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Our pair of legal scholars, Lawrence Rosenthal from Chapman University School of Law, Aaron Kaplan from Loyola Law School, joining us to talk about the case of the Mongol Motorcycle Gang based here in Southern California. A jury deciding last week on Friday that the Mongols should have to give up their trademark logo, which you see on the jackets of motorcycle members of the Mongols on Southern California streets and freeways. Coming up, we're going to talk about efforts to make objective a determination of a patient's pain. You know how there's the scale of pain 1 to 10 that has become popular, but still highly subjective. Is there a way healthcare professionals can better understand what kind of pain a patient is in? We'll get to that right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurtis. Usher up to see you Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotels. We still have tickets available for our Film Week Academy Awards preview. Every year, a week before the Oscars, our critics all gather on stage, Theater at Ace Hotel. We talk about the major categories for the Oscars, who our critics think should be honored, and we see clips of the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures. Tickets are available, kpcc.org/in-person. I sure hope to see you there Sunday afternoon, February 17th, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown L.A. Well, you're probably aware of the 1 to 10 scale of pain, with the little faces that show pain, often used by healthcare givers to determine how much pain a patient is in and to try and judge what sort of pain medication or other mitigation should be used to try and help the patient with her or his pain. But of course, that's highly subjective. It's not really the best way to get a handle on how much pain the patient is really suffering. Well, Dr. Julia Finkel, who's a pediatric anesthesiologist based in D.C., has come up with an experimental device that tracks reactions in the patient's pupil to light and non-painful stimulation of particular nerves. The device is still being developed, and Dr. Finkel and her team are going to be seeking FDA approval. But the hope is that physicians and caregivers will be able to much more accurately determine how much pain a patient is in. We're going to talk about the potential benefits and limits of the device. But first, with us to kind of talk about the challenge of even getting an objective measure of pain is Dr. Shalini Shah, Associate Clinical Professor of Anesthesiology and Director of Pain Management at UC Irvine Health. Dr. Shah, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There's so many variables when it comes to pain. What are the big challenges in making a pain level objective?
Well, in order to understand that, you have to understand the broader context of pain. Pain allowed us to evolve from what we were as single-cell organisms to the complex humans that we are today. And largely, it's dependent on individual sensations to the perceived threat. Really, that's what allowed us to evolve. So as you can imagine, there's an inherent subjectiveness to the pain response. So anytime a new device that's objective and can give us an objective measurement of any part of our health, you can imagine the desirable applications of it.
And how do we perceive pain? Just sort of briefly take us through the physical response to pain. What in the body reacts and gives us the perception?
So at a very basic sense, and I don't want to underestimate or reduce it to the most simplest form, but imagine an injury to the hand. From the periphery, the cell signaling that occurs travels to the spinal cord. From the spinal cord, it travels to the brain. And in the brain is when we have these numerous amounts of neurotransmitters that develop over time and that are affected by environmental factors that allow us to perceive pain. And so that way you can understand how you may perceive pain may be different from the way I perceive pain.
Well, and how does even an individual's mood factor into this? I think I've seen studies that indicate if someone's angry, for example, they experience pain differently than if they're in a positive mood. So that sort of psychological perception of pain, how does that factor in?
Well, it's interesting to note that pain and a mood travel together in the brain. So that when one person has anxiety or depression, oftentimes they will also have pain, and those patients who have pain will often have concomitant anxiety and depression. It's natural for the two to coexist. It doesn't mean that one causes the other, but they do mutually coexist.
We're talking with Dr. Shalini Shah, UC Irvine Health, Clinical Professor of Anesthesiology and Director of Pain Management at UCI Health. We just have word that British lawmakers have voted against Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal. There are only 73 days until Brexit, but members of Parliament overwhelmingly reject the only plan that's on the table for how to exit the EU. It's a record number of UK lawmakers who voted against Theresa May's Brexit deal with no clear path forward. Let me see if I can get the vote figure. 432 to 202. So 432 members of parliament voting against the Brexit deal for the UK's leaving the European Union. More details coming up on NPR News as well as on BBC NewsHour at 1 o'clock this afternoon, an in-depth program devoted to the vote on Brexit and what comes next for the UK. Also with us on Air Talk, Assistant Professor of Clinical Anesthesiology at UC Irvine, Brent Young, who worked with Dr. Finkel on the development of this pain-measuring device. Dr. Young, thank you for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
So how does this device work? Describe it in a bit more detail.
So basically, it's a device that looks at normal physiology or normal human reactivity to pain. And what we, when we're developing and looking at or developing this device to look at pain, we looked at how the pupil responds to actual pain. And then we started to use devices that could look at the pupil and measure the pupil size very accurately and record the reactivity of the eye. And we coupled and integrated that with a sensory stimulator, an electrical sensory device that would activate certain nerve fibers without causing actual pain. and so we, as we're monitoring the eye, we provide the stimulus and see how the eye responds. We were then able to, you know, track eye response after, before and after certain pain medications to see what kind of decrease in pain the patient was saying subjectively and what kind of change we would see in the eye response.
Well, how was it discovered that the eye response, that the pupil is the tell as to how much pain a person's in?
Well, I think it's pretty well known that your eye responds in a certain way in times of pain. And I think that's just a normal human response that we've known for quite a while. It's just the integration or the innovation here is the combination of that with a, you know, peripheral experimental stimuli that could activate the different sensory fibers in the human body.
And what have you seen in the rate of correspondence between the objective measurement and what patients subjectively tell you they're experiencing?
Well, that's what the current research that Dr. Finkel, my mentor, and I are developing currently right now. It's definitely still a work in progress. We're still validating our methods and our methodology, but at least preliminary data is showing some correlation with the eye reactivity and the patient's corresponding pain scores.
And if there's a divergence in those two, what then would it suggest to the physician? Which one to treat according to what the patient tells you or what you see in the supposedly objective examination.
Right. So that's a really good question. Like Dr. Shaw was saying that there are a lot of different components that are input to have somebody's pain score. There's that psychological component, and then there is also, you know, that physical component. If there is not a correlation, there could be a stronger psychological component that's influencing the patient's experience of pain and their subjective score that they're telling us. So we can alter our treatment for that patient by, you know, looking more at treating psychological components of pain, or in converse, if there is a strong correlation with their eye reactivity, then perhaps we should be focusing more on their physical component of pain. But this device doesn't really, you know, look at the entire picture of pain because there are so many factors that are involved with pain itself. This device would hopefully just give us a small objective measurement, a specific component of that pain that we can help to, you know, modify our treatment modalities and the treatments that we offer our patients.
We're talking with Dr. Brent Young of UC Irvine. He's assistant professor of clinical anesthesiology and working with this device that he's been part of the development of a device to try and provide objective information on how much pain a patient is suffering, not just rely on the patient's self-report. Also with us from UCI Health, Dr. Shalini Shah. Coming up, we'll talk with the former president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine and get his thoughts about whether he thinks a device could actually accurately measure someone's pain. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC, back in just a minute. In case you just joined us, British Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit deal defeated today in a vote of Parliament, 432 to 202. So that leaves her already shaky position even wobbling a bit more. And you've got Brexit that's coming up in just a matter of weeks. There's no plan B. So it's back to the drawing board for the UK with its Brexit plans. More details, more coverage coming up on BBC NewsHour right after Fresh Air at 1 o'clock here on KPCC. By the way, on Fresh Air today, John C. Reilly, such a terrific actor who has critically acclaimed performances, Oliver Hardy in the film Stan and Ollie that's out in theaters right now. John C. Reilly talking about his acclaimed performance in that film as the great comedian Oliver Hardy. Right now, it's whether medical science can give us a way of accurately, objectively determining how much pain a patient is in. Because, of course, the ability to provide for more comfortable patient is big here, as well as to more accurately prescribe pain medication and other pain mediation. With us, Dr. Lynn Webster, former president of the American Academy of Pain Medicine and author of The Painful Truth, What Chronic Pain Is Really Like and Why It Matters to Each of Us. Dr. Webster, welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So we've detailed some of the challenges to making this an objective, accurate assessment. Do you think it is possible to come up with a device that can do that?
Well, maybe. I don't know that we're there yet. It's a very complicated problem. Pain is a product of the brain, and every function of the brain can contribute to an individual's experience. So, you know, measuring the pupils may be able to pick up an acute pain response, but usually there's an accommodation after a period of time, and I don't know how it would detect or quantitate the amount of chronic pain somebody's experiencing. And then when you add medications which affect the pupil diameter, many of them will, I'm not sure then how you can interpret that. Unless you're thinking that it's the sum of the medication plus the pain experience. So, you know, I'm a big cheerleader. I hope that they're able to come up with something like this, even if it's just for acute pain and not for chronic pain, but I'm skeptical. We've been working on this for 40 years in the science fields, looking at brain imaging and other types of algometers, and we haven't been able to demonstrate any real proof way to measure and quantitate pain yet.
What a great word, algometers. So everything, it sounds like, again, even if you're looking at brain imaging, it's going to be reacting to whatever pain medication is in the system, presumably. And could the mood of the patient even, you know, be displayed there in the brain scan?
Absolutely. So areas of the brain that are involved with mood are activated. We've been able to observe that, I think, on functional MRIs during pain stimulus. You know, every area of the brain can contribute to a person's pain experience, and it's a dynamic process. And it's also one that's based upon our genetics, our lifetime experience, the context of the pain. So it's a very complicated thing. Now, I will say this, though. I've sat on NIH review committees for grants. And Dr. Finkel has received a grant from NIH to study this. I know that they go through a meticulous process, and there must be something to the proposal, to the science that she's suggested in order for them to give her a grant. So here I am. I'm hoping that she's got something that will work.
Dr. Lynn Webster with us, former president, American Academy of Pain Medicine. We go back to Dr. Shalini Shaw, UC Irvine, the School of Medicine, and Director of Pain Management, UC Irvine Health. If you give someone, let's say, a placebo sugar pill, and you, and setting aside the ethics of this, you tell them that this potentially is going to significantly cut their experience of pain, and they perceive that they are in less pain after you've given them that sugar pill that they don't know is a sugar pill, would there be a difference in the pupil of the eye based on the perception of the patient? Or would the pupil stay in that same sort of pain-indicated position despite the patient's belief that they have less pain?
You know, that's a very good question. Largely, pain studies are troubled with a high degree of placebo response, up to about 30%. So 30% of pain studies have a placebo response. Now, does the pupil change its reactivity in response to pain? Yes, it seems that it does. What about to the perception of pain, or thereby the lower perception of pain because of a placebo response? We don't know. I'm sure Dr. Finkel and her team have evaluated a placebo response. Certainly, in order to validate this device, it will require a placebo trial. But that's an interesting question that we're looking forward to hearing about.
Dr. Young of UC Irvine, a quick word on that.
No, we haven't seen any change in pupillary response to placebo. So people who take placebo and people who do not, there is no change that we've seen, at least in our preliminary studies.
Interesting. So the eye is really not tied to the patient's perception of pain.
Well, with our methodology, we have not seen that yet.
All right. I want to thank you for being with us. That's Dr. Brent Young, UC Irvine, Assistant Professor of Clinical Anesthesiology, working on the device with Dr. Finkel that would hopefully allow for an objective determination of how much pain a patient is in. Our thanks to Dr. Shalini Shaw, also of UCI, and Lynn Webster, Dr. Webster, former President of American Academy of Pain Medicine. Fresh Air with John C. Riley, this week's guest. Coming up next, and then very important coverage. I urge you to stay tuned. It's a big deal. The vote on Brexit, which went against Prime Minister Theresa May today. You're going to hear that story and its major developments coming up 1 o'clock BBC NewsHour right here on 89.3 KPCC. Have a terrific afternoon.